Okay, well, I want to thank the organizers for inviting me here. It's certainly fun, it's a beautiful place. I mean, I'm kind of at a point, I'm glad to be here, but as a picture shows here, I mean, the laboratory, which we moved 18 months ago, is going, and results are coming out of the laboratory, and it's kind of a tough time to be away from the group when, you know, I see them one day every 2 weeks, and they kind of fill me in. So I'm anxious to get back home. Each time I come home, they have new results for me, and I'll start showing you some of these results that are coming out. Just keep in mind, I mean, we're at the kind of the beginning stages. We don't completely understand what's going on, but we're learning. So what will I talk about today? Well, of course, I'll talk about the things that fascinated me. And what has fascinated me is it's a long history, right? When I was a student, kind of in the beginning of the 80s, I remember, you know, seeing all this fascinating work coming out of Saclay, in FOM, and then there was the other leading group that here in the States, at the University of Illinois at Chicago Circle with Charlie Rhodes, right? And there were kind of these competing schemes, right? The hope was that we can couple large amounts of energy into some system, okay? And Saclay group had their 1 micron system going, and Charlie Rhodes had this other approach of using UV excitation, larger photons, right? Charlie always made convincing arguments that this was the way to get large amounts of energies into the atoms, right? Well, what happened? I mean, I would look at those papers and always look at the 1 micron result, and to me, as an experimentalist, what they were observing were a lot more fascinating than what we were seeing from, say, coming out of Rhodes' group. Then in the 90s, we kind of learned that, okay, if I want to get a lot of energy in the system, this is what we believe now, right? What I want to do is couple the photon field to a single electron, okay, that has tunneled ionized in a low frequency field, and let that electron get driven by this strong field, and then that energy gets coupled back into the system either through elastic or inelastic processes, okay? So with that logic, the next step would be, well, why not go longer, okay? And as you'll see, of course, people have gone much longer in wavelength to look at these ideas of large ponder motor fields, and that's what we'll be talking about mainly today. So here's the basic outline. So we'll be talking about these strong field scalings, okay? So these are kind of gauges and metrics that we use that guide us in developing our own tools, right? I mean, these are the things we want to know, what happens beyond 1 micron. Will things all look the same? Will things look classical, completely classical? And so really what I'll talk to you about is strong field physics and my fascinating with strong field physics. Now, it has some practical implications in certain terms of attoseconds, okay, which we're also pursuing. But that's not the end goal. The end goal is that, to me, central to physics is scaling, and I want to understand scaling. And so what we'll do is, of course, as I said, we were setting up the lab for, well, more than a year. So we had idle time. So, all right, what does an experimentalist do when he can't do an experiment? He does theory. So I'll show you some results of some some theory, okay? And you'll see there'll be plenty of room for improvement in the results of the theory that we did. And then I'll start showing you now tidbits of what's coming out of apparatus in the laboratory. Okay, so again, building up a laboratory is especially, well, I would say mid-career, but recently a reviewer called me an old-timer, so. But reestablishing a laboratory took a lot of work, And these are kind of all the people that kind of, you know, just contribute. I mean, graduate students, postdocs, and undergraduates, just to get this laboratory back up and going. I just want to mention my collaborators, Pierre Agostini, you see back there. The calculations were done with this coat of arms, Mueller, that's been referenced a lot here, I think. Teddy August and Pascal Serrière. Okay, so here's our first metric, all right, the Keldysh pitch, all right? This simple picture that somehow makes describes limits between what you would call tunnel ionization or a multi-photon description in terms of this dimensionless parameter, which is just the ratio of the optical frequency to the tunneling frequency. As gamma becomes less than 1, okay, at low frequencies or at very high intensities, large Ponder motor potentials, then you're in this kind of tunneling limit, this tunneling limit that we so much adopted in our understanding of strong field physics nowadays in terms of the quasi-classical description. And of course, if the frequency is very high, then this photon description. So, you know, there was talk by Phil's talk on LCLS and XFELs are kind of putting us in this regime initially. So here's a kind of global map. It's not complete, but I think it conveys what has been done in studying strong fields. All right. And these bars represent experiments that were done, okay? And in order to get on my graph, I needed to see an experiment that was more than just measuring a total ionization rate. So if you looked at some differential cross-section, extracted more information than a rate, you made my graph here. So here's a plot of frequency versus field amplitude in atomic units. The dotted line is, say, Keldysh equal to 1, gamma equal to 1 for the hydrogen atom. Okay, and you can see here, here's the results of, you know, titanium sapphire and 1 micron excitation. And you can see it kind of spans across this realm of gamma equal 1. Here's kind of the UV excitation, say, that was done at the University of Illinois and where they lie in phase space. This red line is kind of what we're trying to achieve, the lower frequency and deeper into the tunneling. And that's a singular point, that little purple point that says CO2. This was the famous 88 experiment done by Paul Corkum for looking at the kind of the simple man picture. Okay, now, there's been a tremendous amount of literature based on microwave excitation, beautiful work, very detailed work. And that extracted, you know, wonderful physics from it. And that's represented by this blue line here at lower frequency. And of course, often those microwave experiments are done in scaled hydrogenic systems. So this gray line here represents, say, a gamma equal 1 for N equal 100 in hydrogen. And now here's the same plot, frequency versus Keldysh parameter. And you can see the type of experiments we mainly do are just at this border of gamma equal 1. And if we really try to push deeper to this gamma, much less than 1 as described by Keldysh, we have very few atoms in the near visible or near infrared that actually sample this part of phase space. So again, our experiments are hoping to push the much lower values of gamma. And as we see it, you know, the quasi-classical model should just work better and better, right? What I won't talk about today, but I just want to convey that, you know, looking at the scaling gives you a different set of tools in our laboratory for looking at unusual systems, okay? And so I break down this, you know, the Keldysh picture into some simple form. I think what Keldysh was saying is that you can always find equivalent interactions no matter where you look in the electromagnetic spectrum. I mean, that is scaling. Okay? So one could imagine, I mean, inert gases are the favorite atom that people look at in strong field for generating attoseconds or whatever. But, you know, I can go to a lower binding energy system and try to achieve an equivalent interaction at a much lower frequency. So that's one thing we have been pursuing. And of course, if we're working with these lower frequency systems, and let me just quickly show it. So these are old experiments, and this part of the program is really just getting underway back at Ohio State. This is experiments that we first did at Brookhaven. But this is, you know, an alkali, right? 4-volt binding energy exposed to 3.5 micron radiation. And here you see high harmonics coming off an alkali. Okay, that's interesting. What's also interesting about it, and I think we'll hear from Alexei, I mean, just look at the wavelength scale. These are high harmonics that are in the visible and near UV. So this gives us certain advantages also in terms of tools that we can use to study this that, say, are not available in the more traditional experiments. And here you see an early photoelectron spectrum of potassium, and you see electrons here. Those structures, all that little noise is real, right? These are 0.3 eV photons, and here you can see lots of photons being absorbed. Of course, in absolute energy, they're only 15 volt electrons, say maximum. But in terms of a scale to say some ponder motive energy, they certainly go out to 10 UP as we would expect from a simple classical argument. But now let's turn our attention to atoms in large ponder motive potential. So here's, of course, a very important metric in the strong field is this ponder motive energy, right? And, of course, one way of getting this ponder motive energy is to increase the intensity, okay? That becomes limited just in terms of dynamics in how an atom or gets depleted in some laser pulse. So intensity has been the knob that people have been using, and the binding energy of the atom itself. But of course, there's also this strong dependence, this quadratic dependence on wavelength. Okay, and so the wavelength knob looks like a good one. Okay, but what's the problem? Well, the problem is our best laser is titanium sapphire, ultra short laser. So you need to, you know, develop new technology to get out to these longer wavelengths, but, you know, there's solutions now. OPA, you know, just parametric processes. Just in a tabular form then, and of course this tabular form represents the wavelengths that we're building the capabilities in, okay? So you look at the helium atom at saturation exposed to 800 nanometer light and 2 micron light, so you get this lambda squared boost in the ponder motive energy, and you go from UP of somewhere around 80 volts to about a half a kilovolt at 2 microns. Okay, in terms of thinking about that as harmonic generation, you move from, you know, 300 volts above a kilovolt in terms of producing a cutoff. You can take that further. What happens at 4 microns? Well, of course, again, you just get a lambda squared, and now it looks possible to produce 7 kilovolt photons, and of course, 2.2 kilovolts UP says that I should see 22 kilovolt electrons coming off this system. Okay, so that's what we'll be looking at the end. So we're looking both at photons and electrons coming out of these large ponder motive fields. And of course now everyone's expectation, which is correct, the efficiency for the rescattering, which you rely upon to produce high energy photons and electrons, is going to drop off. And the question is, how severe is that? But here's a kind of another strategy to this. If I look at helium, which often is not used in the laboratory to generate attosecond pulses, right? Because the efficiency is so low. But if I look at helium at 800 nanometers, if I did xenon at 4 microns, if I can do xenon at 4 microns, I would essentially get the same extent of the spectrum with xenon. Okay, so you can use larger Z atoms, and how that would translate into efficiency and phase matching, you know, remains to be seen. All right, so let's just start with some of the calculations. So the main part of this is done using the single active electron model of single active electron approximation by solving the time-dependent Schrödinger equation. And again, this is Hahn-Müller's code. And here I present the electron spectrum and the harmonic spectrum that comes out of these codes. Again, there's no phase matching. It's all single atom. The blue curve is argon at 800 nanometers. You see nice ATI structure. This is plotted in UP. And just like you would observe in the laboratory, the argon really doesn't look classical, right? I mean, it extends, it kind of falls off monotonically, extends beyond where you would expect the classical cutoffs. But if you go to 2 microns, you can see it takes this very classical looking spectrum. There's a kind of rapid fall off with a break at around 2 UP, okay? And then this spectrum extends out and cuts off again at 10 UP due to the elastic scattering. And if I can read that, so UP, just in terms of absolute energy, UP in the blue curve is about 9 volts. That means somewhere around 10 UP is 90 volts. And for the 2 micron results, it's 56 volts. So this cutoff here in the red spectrum is at about a half a kilovolt. Okay, and here's the harmonic spectrum now just plotted in terms of absolute energy. The blue curve is what you would expect from harmonics out of argon. With red light, it cuts off about 50. You know, it's good to generate out to about the 29th order. And here you can see this 2 micron result goes out to about 200 EV. Okay, now the question of efficiency, right? I mean, the efficiency depends upon how you analyze the spectrum, okay? So what we chose to do is analyze the spectrum by just looking at the total power spectrum emitted at these harmonics. And that's what's plotted here. So this is the integrated spectrum, okay, of harmonics. The blue dots are those from the TDSE calculation. The crosses are the work of Pascal and Terry using the strong field approximation in helium. Okay, and the red and lines are just fits. And you can see as you move from 800 nanometers out to 2 microns, this thing seems to be scaled, dropping off as 1/λ5, 1/λ6. So it's much more rapid than, say, you would look if you looked at kind of the strong field model. You kind of see this lambda cube term, which, you know, you get a lambda squared just from the wave packet spread, and you get another lambda in the conversion of energy into number of photons. Okay, but in fact, the power spectrum from the single atom calculation seems to drop off much more rapidly than that. And this seems consistent. Wilhelm did a calculation in 94 using a zero range potential in 3D. By kind of analyzing Wilhelm's spectrum, that's why I put qualitative agreement, it looks like it's also dropping off somewhere around 5 or 6. So this is not good news. Right, so now I want to give you a time frequency plot, and I just want to say a word of how we generate that. So what we do is we calculate this harmonic spectrum, okay? And in this analysis you're going to see is we're going to just apply, and this has been done by a number of people, just apply a frequency window, take some bandwidth around some central frequency, and then inverse transform that into time. So now we'll get some train of attosecond pulses coming out. And we'll step that window across the plateau, and that gives the plot you see here. I should mention, and it should be apparent here, this analysis that you're seeing is now a flat top pulse, like 9-cycle flat top pulse. Okay, so you're looking actually one half, the second half cycle. So the first half cycle, nothing happens because there's no rescattering. So you should interpret this plot. If you take a line out here, that's the central wavelength or central frequency of our window. Okay, and this is the time dependence then of the inverse transform of that bandwidth. Okay, and here you can see within the second half cycle, you see the short trajectory, the tau 1 trajectory, you see the tau 2 trajectory, and as you go from half cycle to half cycle, you see it becomes rather complex looking. You still see evidence of the short, perhaps the long, but there's a lot of interference here, which, you know, has its origin in this these higher order returns. Okay, and just keep in mind that all these higher order returns, just classically, are just children of the long trajectory. Okay, you do the same analysis now at 2 microns. Okay, and that's what you see here. And again, within the half cycle, you see the short and long trajectory. The black lines are purely the classical result. Okay, and you can see it fits rather nicely with these higher order returns. Okay, in fact, what's surprising to us here is the fact that these higher order returns, and I think Ann mentioned it earlier, carry a lot of amplitude. I mean, to me, it almost seems that the wave packet spread got mediated in some way to give such strong emission in these subsequent half cycles. So from this analysis, we can look at how does now this atto chirp, right, this thing that kind of limits how short of a pulse you can make, behave as a function of wavelength. And I'll just show you that result for the short trajectory. So here's the atto chirp extracted from the calculation. Those are the dots as a function of wavelength. And you can see as you go the longer wavelength, the atto chirp actually gets smaller. So, and it goes as 1 over lambda. So you can generate shorter attosecond pulses at longer wavelengths just due to this reduction in the atto chirp, right? You can get the same reduction in atto chirp with intensity, but you also get it in wavelength. And it's just a simple classical argument. This atto chirp is really just depends upon the time in the continuum and upon the mode of energy. Okay, so that just gives you a simple 1 over lambda scaling. All right, so now let's look at some results as they're coming out. And here's so the decor for our lab is blue, by the way. So, okay, we have this standard 800 nanometer system, a commercial system with carry envelope phase stabilization. We have this 4-micron system, which generates somewhere around 0.25 millijoule in 80 femtoseconds. So they're about 6-cycle pulses. We also have this 2-micron system, just based on parametric amplification that produces about 0.5 millijoule in 50 femtoseconds, so that's about 7 cycles. And what we're developing, thanks to the National Science Foundation, is a new type of technology that would be competitive with a titanium sapphire laser that's based on this principle of OPCPA, and that should get us to if this is successful, a very good driver for, say, harmonics in attoseconds, and it should produce something very comparable to titanium sapphire. So here's a result just to show you that the tools of, you know, are similar to what we have at 800 nanometers. And this is a result that was done in my laboratory with a collaboration at LOR and Michigan. Christoph Hari and Rodrigo Lopez and Eric Power came for a couple of weeks, all right, and they're kind of experts in these filaments, and they took the 2-micron OPA, made this filament, which you see here, this green line, and then we kind of measure how much compression we're getting. And our best result in just a single pass through this with self-compression, okay, so there was no need for any chirp mirrors or prisms. We got down to 12 femtoseconds. So that's about slightly less than a 2-cycle pulse. The other thing that's demonstrated here in the frequency spectrum, this is just F2F spectral beating, is that the carry envelope phase is stabilized out of this 2-micron source, and it's stable. Well, the two curves here with the nice interference fringes were averaged over a minute, okay, so 60,000 pulses. Okay, so with those tools, let's start looking. And here's now just a comparison. Here's xenon photoelectron distributions taken at those three wavelengths. The black curve is the 800 nanometer result. In fact, the black curve, since I couldn't find one at the proper intensity, is at saturation. Okay, the red and blue curve are at half saturation, half that intensity, but they're done at the longer wavelength. And immediately you see, as you move the wavelength out, you get more energetic particles. You see those blue spectrum there. Finally, you go out to 4 microns, and xenon's cutting off somewhere around, 400 volts or so. Okay, but you'll notice in this next one where I just kind of normalized everything to 1, put things in ponder mode of energy. And here's the argon at 800 nanometer. You see the nice ATI. You see the Rydberg resonance at low energy. But the blue one now starts falling off rapidly and around 2 UP, again, looking very classical. And as you go to 4 microns, you can see it drops down even further. So the rescattering in this case, it seems to be dropping off in terms of production of this elastic scattering. Okay, so this was exciting for us in terms of the performance of the 2-micron source, but here's helium at saturation at 2 microns. Okay, and this is, again, an absolute energy. The black curve is just an 800 nanometer spectrum, which we spent a lot of time studying. Again, it has the very classical shape, which you can't see here. It falls off rapidly. That's about the 2 UP break in the 800 nanometers. Then it continues to fall and cuts off at about 500 volts. That's 10 UP in the case of helium. And now you see at 2 microns, 2 UP is at this point here. So UP now, helium is experiencing about 400 volts upon the mode of energy. And you can see there's few counts out here, but they're real. And, we're getting 3 kilovolt electrons off helium. So we're putting in these 0.6 EV photons and producing 3 kilovolt particles. And finally, and this result is really warm. In fact, it's not even 2 weeks old. Here's argon at 2 microns, but the harmonic spectrum. And what you see here is this is the harmonic spectrum. Okay, here's the order. Here's the energy. You see the different harmonic orders going out here to say 111. At this point, we're using an aluminum filter. Aluminum absorbs at 70 volts, so we don't see. So the rapid cutoff here is just the absorption of our aluminum filter. And we're having trouble we're trying to understand how this thing works. Now, here's, we put a different filter in, zirconium, which should allow us to look out somewhere around 200 volts. But this is just garbage, okay? Because we can't stop the 2 microns from getting to our detector with the zirconium. But this part of the spectrum is real. It's the harmonics. And right here, at this point here, we know we produce at least 100 volt photons out of the argon. And this stuff is probably real. So we're still not at the cutoff. I mean, we want to see the cutoff. The cutoff should be around somewhere around 200 volts. So hopefully when I get back home, they're starting to solve some of these problems. But so I'll stop here, and thank you for your attention.
When you try to make harmonics with longer wavelengths, you increase the recollision time and you increase the ponder motive radius of the electron. and therefore the wave packet spreads more and more. Doesn't that contribute to the decrease of efficiency?
Yes, yes. I think when you look at SFA again, this 1 over lambda cubed that you see, the lambda squared is just the wave packet spread. But it's fallen off much more rapidly. Again, it depends how you look at this. If you do the analysis for a particular harmonic order, you would see this lambda cubed. Or you do the analysis differently at a constant bandwidth and same absolute energy, you'll find that it's dropping off as well. We saw all crazy things, lambda to the 10, lambda to the 15.
A connected question. Together, when you increase the wavelength, not only the ponderomotive energy increases, but also the drift of electron in the forward direction just due to the magnetic field of mm-hmm. the laser also increases.
That's right.
Does it influence somehow? Have you considered
at that helium result, it's starting to get interesting. And that's right. One of the fundamental things that interests us in the talk we heard the other day talking about positronium is the possibility at these longer wavelengths of getting a neutral atom to go relativistic. And that's part of our objective is to study relativistic effects in a neutral. And you're right. The V cross B, becomes significant at much lower intensity.
Your experiments, can you combine 2-micron and 4-micron pulses?
No, they're independent systems. We can certainly double the 4 microns, because our metrology relies upon that. So we can work at, the fundamental and it's harmonic, it's second harmonic.
Higher energies than you have here in your simulations because 800 nanometers in helium.
That's right.
Has already gone to 3 kilovolts, and argon's already gone to 1/4 of a kilovolt with 800.
If we go down to say 2-cycle pulses,
yeah.
Right?
Because I guess ADK always underestimates, so the cutoff is always
a little
higher than you think.
Yes, that's right.
And experimentally, yes. One sees that.
So. Yes, I agree. Yes. And by the way, the 2-micron results I showed you today were just with these 50 femtoseconds. We haven't brought the 2-cycle pulses in any of the experiments. In fact, Christoph is coming back in like a week or so, and his objective is to put that 2-micron on some target.
I guess the story is probably a little bit complicated because if you just look at the cutoff law, you have lambda squared I. I is saturation intensity, right? If you go to long wavelengths, you're not going to get as short pulse as the short wavelengths.
You're not going to...
Because your cycle is getting longer,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's right.
So
that's right.
The saturation intensity for long wavelengths is going to be lower than short wavelengths because you just simply cannot get as short pulse as short wavelengths. So you gain from lambda squared, but because of ultimate shortest pulse duration you can get with long wavelengths, you cannot improve as much as you can just from lambda squared.
Well,
argument.
Yeah, I think those changes will be much smaller than the win of lambda squared.
Agree. But I'm simply saying it's not just from lambda squared.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing is, of course, phase matching. I mean, with lambda squared, with in plasma, the dispersion is larger than mm-hmm. it. So when we did experiment also with 1.5 micron, we find it's not squared. It's not scaling with lambda squared because of phase matching.
Mm-hmm. That, okay.
Yeah, we see a factor of 2 increase in cutoff, not factor of 4. When we doubled wavelengths.
Yeah, these are certainly things, that we certainly don't have the ability to control our light yet because we can't see it as well.
Sure.
And once we develop those tools, I the goal is really to kind of quantitatively check these things.
I do have another question. When you produce this 2-cycle pulse by the fermentation, what is the energy? Do you lose energy from the fermentation process?
Yeah. I think the best estimate is about 50% couples through the filament.
Thank you.
You know, we're at an advantage since we just use a little glass, right? Since it already has a negative GVD beyond 1.5 microns, we don't get any losses from any. We just self-compress it by passing it through a little glass.
At your placement for ATI, how was the pulse duration?
How long?
How long was the pulse duration?
Okay, so for that xenon ATI?
You have shown that the cutoff was lower in your experiment in some case. So I suspect the reason can be...
This here or this here?
The one that when you have cutoff, yeah, this one.
Yes.
Okay, this red curve,
yes.
Which is cutoff is about 8 UP. Usually it is at 10 UP.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But I suppose it was just a few cycle pulse and...
No. Let's just examine this. This is an experiment, right? So this is dropping off from here. The here is already 5 orders of magnitude. Okay, and we're counting a few electrons per shot. So they're just running out of dynamic range. The students don't want to wait around a long time to get enough counts. So, okay. You know, that may fill in. So we're just running out of statistics at that point. It's the same thing we suffered when we studied helium at 800 nanometer at the high intensity. It's just you need to count for a very long time.
Okay.
Okay, I think we have to move on. Thank Lou again.